Hello and welcome back to The Great Game, an Australian mega game podcast. This is episode 7, The Owl League, and I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jack. Before we get into the episode, just one major announcement to make. The Mega Game Coalition is putting on an online mega games con, and they're currently looking for submissions for that. So they're looking for anyone who has a virtual mega game or is interested in joining or having a seminar or talk about the concepts of online mega games to join up. So we'll have a link to that in the description. Definitely check it out if you're interested in that. And that'll be kicking off sometime between mid-August and onwards.
This episode on the podcast, we're actually talking to Stefan, who's from the very same Mega Game Coalition and the curator of the upcoming Magic Coffee House, who was nice enough to join us and have a chat about online mega games and the landscape that the hobby's found itself in. And of course, we jump in and explore his new game, The Owl League, which is an online fantasy sports mega game that's coming very soon. So let's get into it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Stefan. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, the question we'll kind of get started with here. Tell us a bit about your history. Like, how did you get into mega gaming? And I guess, what have you been up to over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like a lot of folks, I fell into mega gaming around that time in like 2015-ish when Shut Up and Sit Down had put out their first iteration of Watch the Skies that they played over in the UK. And, you know, of course, that idea was just too incredible to pass up. So from there, I kind of found a bunch of places in New York that were running Watch the Skies and started working with them and then started designing my own stuff that I then brought to different conventions across America.
Yeah, great. So tell us more about your own stuff. Like, what kind of stuff are you up to there?
Sure. So the first game I wrote was a sci-fi game called Contact Light. And it was not that great. It was not good for a lot of reasons. It was really ambitious. And it had a lot of really cool ideas. It revolved around a lot of tech that just wasn't up to the number of players.
Right. How many players was that? Sorry.
I believe it was 60.
Okay.
It was a full game, and I can't remember what the like full player count was, but it was somewhere around 60 players. And I'm a software engineer by trade, so right. I tried to build out some tech that would allow for kind of simulating a huge galaxy map for players to interact with and be in.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of fell apart immediately. Like turn one, it was a bit of a mess. So I think people enjoyed it, but like because of some of these like logistical problems, that was kind of where it fell off.
We'll go on to the other games you've been a part of in a second, but considering we're just going to be talking a bit about your new mega game, which is also online, is that something you'd consider doing again, like that kind of technological integration with a mega game, or is it something you feel a bit wary of?
Yeah, definitely. I think the tech nowadays is just so much better. Mm. Like it's a lot easier to do things that you really couldn't do even like 4 years ago very easily. Like Discord, for instance, is something that is now almost at a level of like ubiquity with players that it can facilitate that sort of communication and communication like internationally, right? So even having a conversation with you guys is just as simple as having one with someone, you know, close to home. So I think part of that it would be definitely, you know, I think the Owl League itself definitely wouldn't happen if something like Discord wasn't around.
Right.
But then on top of that, just knowing more about the tech and about what I'm writing now today versus what I was writing like 5 years ago, I think is a huge difference. Yeah.
Awesome. And yeah, so sorry to interrupt you before. Tell me more about the stuff you progressed onto after Contact Lion.
Yeah, so the next game I did was part of the board game company I ran called Ironmark Games. And so us and a couple friends designed a American Revolution mega game called The World Turned Upside Down. And that worked a lot better than Contact Light. It was a lot more polished and had a lot more elements of like tabletop board gaming compared to some of the like video gamey kind of elements that I was incorporating with my previous game. So that worked out great, and that was a game that we took to a bunch of different conventions like Gen Con, PAX Unplugged, and really brought it to conventions that really weren't didn't have mega games at the time. You know, it wasn't even a thing in a lot of conventions in America, and we were helping to bring it with that mega game.
That's one of the mega games I was really interested in back when I was getting started designing stuff, actually. And I remember years ago we had a chat about that, in talking about it in comparison to God Emperor, because they both shared that same kind of mechanic of using people as resources, or like a worker placement game for people, which I still think is really fascinating and awesome mechanic.
Yeah, and especially at the scale of mega games, it feels like it only makes sense that you know, if you think of time as a resource for a player, then you acting as that entity is taking up the time that is being, you know, eaten up. So being able to like use yourself as like, where am I most important, is such a key thing to mega games.
Yeah, it's awesome. I really love it. I do have a question. So one of the pieces of feedback I got that Patrick actually has given me in relation to God Emperor is that sometimes with that mechanic, it can feel a bit like you are a meeple being pushed around. You know what I mean? Like that you're, I suppose that you're going to a place because you need to be there, but that you don't have as much agency or interaction in that place as you might have otherwise. Have you ever felt that, or is that something you think you've avoided?
That's interesting. So in The World Turned Upside Down, I think it's a little streamlined in that there's really only three types of actions you can do. You can either, you know, be on the front lines as a commander. You can go to Parliament and kind of do all the role playing of passing bills and things like that, or you can be in the spy ring. And I think each of them, what's nice was that each of them still had a sort of core game mechanic that that you can enjoy. And it never really felt like someone was going to a section out of obligation. You know, if someone really liked Hidden Role games, they would just go to the spy ring. If someone really liked, you know, war gaming and moving troops around, then they would go to the war room. And I think that I don't think it was as imperative in terms of like, well, if we don't get enough people into, you know, into Congress, then this very specific bill won't pass. Like, at least I haven't heard that feedback previously.
Yeah, when I was playing in God Emperor, which I think was the first run of it, I don't think there was any negative feelings about it, but what we did find was just the way that the narrative played out for our team. Our strategy was to flood certain areas with our teammates because of the bonuses that we'd get at those points. And so, for example, there was a time when nearly everybody in our team went to the council because we needed to, you know, lead a revolution or something, and it looked cool and the role play elements of it were pretty cool, but if that's not what everyone on the team digs, then they're kind of using their turn just as a resource. But I don't think it went over poorly with anyone. It was just an interesting sort of side note.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what was also interesting for The World Turned Upside Down was, I think traditionally you would have three players that you could theoretically be like, okay, one person goes to Spiring, one person goes to the War Room, one person goes to Parliament. But part of the asymmetry for the different colonies was that you might not have that many people. Or if you were a bigger team, you might have even more than three people. So I think there were, I think part of that challenge was integrated into the, like, the narrative, if you will, or at least the, like, the historical context of how much pull a certain colony had compared to another.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right. That sounds like you've got a bit of background with playing around with some sort of unique ideas. I wanted to steer us over to the Owl League, but before that, just really wanted to get your thoughts, Stefan, when you jumped in and said, all right, well, we're going to make this online mega game that's solely designed to operate in the digital world. What did you see as the big challenges and opportunities of doing that rather than a live game?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge is always going to be the tech. I think just making sure that, even more so than tech, like, that things translate well. You know, like, we've been having a lot of conversations, or I've been having a lot of conversations as a part of the Mega Game Coalition, where a lot of the discussion kind of rolls around things that are so simple in person, but now have to be codified in a digital space, right? So something like trading, if I'm in a room and I have, you know, I have a bunch of money in my hand, I can just be like, here's some money. But now that we're in a digital space, it has to be like, okay, well, am I going to be putting that into a spreadsheet? Am I going to be managing that by either having control move the money, or am I going to give them the ability to move the money? And all of these questions that, like, you don't necessarily have to ask in a physical space, you now have to, like, find a technical way of solving.
Yep.
So that part's huge, yeah.
I think just on that, before you tell us about all the opportunities, which I'm sure there's a lot. I feel like we encountered that most strongly with the Dark and Stormy game that we ran, with getting the rules across to people. I found that was such a challenge when you're not sitting in a room, especially in the format that we did it, which is, I believe, somewhat similar to our league, where it was a long form where people had an entire day to do actions and that kind of thing. The format of writing down answers to questions and writing out rules and relying on that written text, rather than just being able to answer questions as people come up to you in a hall or something, was really drastically different and a huge challenge.
Yeah, and I think, like, that also translates to just the ability to control or to, like, run a game.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's just certain things where, you know, to that point, being able to have a conversation really quickly and someone understand something very quickly, compared to also being able to, like, be in a room and sense, like, okay, is this part of the game working well? Do I need to step in and, like, you know, add more to it, add less to it? Do I need to, you know, find what parts of the game are, like, lagging, or what parts of the game are being, like, too excitable, you know, or
yeah,
like that.
None
of that translates online. Yeah,
no, it doesn't. And I've always had, like, a bit of advice to my control team is, like, to read the room and read people and feel the energy and know, like you were just saying, know where things aren't working and where they are. And I found that definitely online, especially since our game was very text-based, it was really hard for players, I think, to read each other and to understand when things were, like, serious or set in humor, or if people were being subtle about something, or you know, or if they were just poorly communicating. There were so many things that you lose when you're not face to face, which I don't think is necessarily a terrible thing, but it's definitely something to navigate.
Yeah, and it's like all of those things about, like, how you talk online versus in person, right? Mm-hmm. Having even just a voice conversation and being able to like sense someone's tone, like you're saying, versus someone who's trying to be sarcastic via text is just, it's a wide valley of, you know, information.
Yeah,
definitely.
And so taking mega games online, what were you expecting to see as the big opportunities, like the big wins?
Well, I mean, definitely the fact that, you know, all of this tech is so available to a lot of people. I feel like the biggest opportunity is the fact that all of these different groups around the world are able to like hop into a game together and play, you know, play mega games that you wouldn't have been able to be in, or like be in those rooms that you couldn't be in because you lived thousands of miles away. Now all of these players can hop in together, right? Like, you know, I know you guys are set to play the Owl League, and that's like, you know, that's something we just couldn't think of doing in person, right? Because you'd have to either be lucky enough to be in America at the time I'm running it, or I have to be out there, you know, all of these things that we're now able to bridge that gap, I think is so huge. I think that it really will change how mega gamers like are able to interact with each other.
Yeah, that's super exciting. That is a really exciting thing for me, and also very excited to play Owl League when it gets run. But yeah, that's something I've felt a lot living in Australia, away from you know, a lot of the main mega game scenes in England and in the US. Is each scene feels very localized and very splintered in a way. And often it'll be a situation where you see someone post about a mega game online or something, and then that post is all you'll ever know about it, right?
Yep. Because you weren't 100%, there.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, what, this looks really interesting. What is it? And maybe you can hunt down the designer on Facebook or something and have a conversation. But generally, it's, you know, it's a local thing that's being run for the people who are in that area very specifically. And if you're not in that area, then you'll never know what that game was, or you know, which is not absolutely the fault of anyone involved. It's just the medium, really,
the nature. But, yeah. Yeah, and that's also something that I think is beneficial about moving to an online space, is the ability to like spectate mega games, unlike you would be able to before. Like, definitely the first question I was getting consistently about the Owl League was, how can I watch it? How can I, like, even if I'm not playing it, how can I see the matches happen? How can I spectate this sport, right? And initially it wasn't my intent to like, you know, open up the Discord or open up like the space so that other people can see it. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, well, why not? Of course, you know, it's a sport just like any other sport that you want to follow and follow the same storylines for. So why not use the tech that we have now to open it up to anyone that can see it?
That's awesome.
Yeah. That step to having people streaming mega games and having symposiums about them, it's, and having spectators in general, it's crazy. Because I've actually had a few people ask in the past in Sydney if they could come along and just observe, and I'm not sure if that's a common thing or not. But I mean, it's definitely led to the recruitment of new people, because it's a spectacle to see. But I'd never thought about it being so easily accessible just to observe and see what it's all about.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and we would do a lot of conferences that my team would run mega games in, where we were often put in very large spaces. And we would be in like a corner of a large space. So inevitably someone would come around and be like, why are all these people talking about the American Revolution, or about like, you know, taxes and things like that. You know, there was even like a moment where Gen Con, you know, the big tabletop convention in Indianapolis, we played in the Lucas Oil Field Stadium, which is the like American football stadium in Indy.
Oh, cool.
And we were given a PA so that the players can hear it, but obviously you're in a stadium, so it just carries. And so it was one moment where the American teams wrote the Declaration of Independence.
Mm.
And so I said, okay, whoever wrote it can give, like, you know, a minute of the declaration they wrote. And of course, the person who they decided to write it was playing as Benedict Arnold. So historically, it was very funny to, like, hear me announce that, like, Benedict Arnold is going to be submitting the Declaration of Independence, and then having this guy, you know, put out his version of the declaration. It's very, you know, it's funny, but also everyone was like, what is happening? What are people doing, you know?
That's awesome. Yeah, great to hear. I think that could definitely bring a lot more people into the format for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so enough beating around the bush, I guess. Tell us, what is our league, actually? Can you give us an elevator pitch for what our league is and why it's cool?
Sure. So the Owl League, I've been always explaining it as like a fantasy sports mega game, where players are, you know, put in teams to basically run a magical sports team. So that looks like kind of the higher level aspects of being like the owners of a sports team. So talking about like, you know, the different ways that you can like promote your franchise, you know, to your sports population, but also the management of those players that you have. So talking about figuring which players would be best for your team, then also figuring out, like, as a coach, how you want to use those players on individual matches. So that high level of saying, like, well, I'm not LeBron James, but I'm going to be playing as, like, you know, one of the, like, famous NBA coaches, and then doing kind of like a higher level view of what being a part of sports is like, and then blending that with this fantasy element of being in a kind of modern magical setting. So a lot of like, it's similar to like the Magicians, or like you know, like Harry Potter in a way, where this magical world exists everywhere, but it's under the surface for like normal people don't necessarily see it, but all of these magical people are able to connect in these ways that other people can't see. And so that's kind of where I wanted to marry those two ideas, like this fantasy element and then this like sports element, and push them together.
Yeah, and you've touched on some of the inspiration there, but where you mention this sort of thematic idea of having this modern fantasy, and you've cited a couple of like Harry Potter and the Magicians there, and how there's this fantastical world operating in secret away from everyone else. Is that, without giving too much away, I suppose, is that mechanically built into the game? Is that part of it? Or
yeah. So part of, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was actually just make a wholly new sport. So I don't know if do you guys have like fantasy football, fantasy sports in Australia? Is that popular?
Yeah. I can't speak to whether it's popular, but it exists.
Sure.
Yeah, I've never been involved in it, but I do know that it does exist.
Okay. So in America, it's very popular with football, specifically American football. And there's a really good like game flow to the way that American football is kind of scheduled on the weekends. Like games only happen on Thursday, Sunday, and Monday for most of the time. And so a lot of fantasy football kind of feels like a mega game. It already has this sense of like, okay, I'm planning for what I'm going to be doing, or how I'm setting up my roster for the end of the week. And so I really loved the aspect of fantasy football, but the game, the sport of football itself, and how it gets scored in the fantasy sports setting is very random. So you might know a lot about what you're doing, and you might know a lot about the players you're taking, but like it's such a random sport that, you know, one play could all of a sudden like make half your team not viable, or, you know, lose you so many points because of like one random call. So I felt like if I wanted to make a sports mega game, I'd want to make a new sport that would be a little easier to ingest, a little bit more accessible for a lot of folks, but also using fantasy to kind of open the boundaries of what that game could be like, right? So not necessarily putting people in boxes of like, well, how fast are they? How quickly can they run the, you know, 100 meters, or how far can they throw a specific ball? I can kind of like move all those stats into like magical abilities and like things like that. Yeah.
Awesome. That's really cool. So how long have you been working on the game?
Yeah. So the initial playtest for the Owl League, the very first time we tried it was actually a little over a year ago. The other big inspiration I had at the time was I was getting really into esports and the Overwatch League in general, which is kind of where the name comes from. So that was something where, again, I was like really enjoying the kind of sports aspect of how they played the game and how different storylines evolved in the same way. Mm. So I built the very first version of that a lot closer to Overwatch in general. So it was a lot of like, you had different class types, and you had to make sure that like the class pairings went well together. And it was a lot of, it got way more complicated than I wanted it to be. But That was like a year and change ago. And I learned a lot through that playtest. And from there, it kind of evolved and evolved and got to this point where we are today, where it was like, oh, well, now we can't do mega games in person. Why don't we try this like game that I was able to have online and playtest with a lot of people and try and make it, you know, a full-fledged game.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So was it always online from that first playtest?
Yeah, so just to get enough players to playtest the game, I ran it, you know, very similarly to the way it is now. It was on Discord. You submitted things via like Google Sheets and Google Forms, things like that. But the intention was always like after I've gotten like the tech and the like sport part down, that it would be converted into a physical game. So there was a lot of like writing two different rule sets of like, what would this look like in person? And then what would this look like online? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously now that we're in this state, that the online rule set kind of took over.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting, because when I saw it and when I've been listening to you talk about how it's going to work, I just assumed it was definitely going to be it was built for online. It was specifically tailored. So that'd be fascinating to see it, as you've described, be in the live format.
Yeah.
Do you think that you'll ever get it to that point following, you know, when everyone's allowed to go back out and play these things in the live format? Have you continued work on that version of the game?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of the changes I made to them actually grew out of the ideas I wanted to have in a live format. So again, like I was saying, I was kind of going back to those sort of tabletop roots, and it's like, what, you know, what are common practices in tabletop games? Like, variable scores, the variable like items that have different scores in them, like pulling them out of a bag and figuring out what which elements you're trying to go for, you know, playing a card one at a time as opposed to like playing your entire hand at once. Those sorts of things are much easier to do in a physical space where you can like see your opponent one-on-one, but much harder when you're expecting everyone to be at completely different times and not knowing when, you know, someone's going to play their turn effectively. So, so that was the part where I was like, okay, I'm going to take some of these good, these elements about scoring and like game design that I like from the physical space, but then adjusting them for what makes sense for the population of players I have online.
And at this point, you've done a bit of playtesting. Would you say that it's ready? Like, obviously, you're about to run it for the first time, but is it at the point where you think you wanted it to be?
Yeah, I think on a like mega game level or on a global kind of level, it's definitely I think the ideas are solid and the workflow for a lot of those players I think makes sense. The finer details are the parts that I'm, you know, I'm curious how it'll affect the game in person. So like how stats will change for different players and how those like kind of bitsy parts will evolve. You know, those are harder to see without actually having players, but but in general, yeah, I'm pretty excited for it.
And the playtesting itself, just briefly, did you how many sessions of playtesting have you done, and what did they entail?
So it was outside of that very first iteration. That was the biggest playtest that I had, where I had about like 20 plus players online playing it. Since then, it's been a lot of individual playtests. So playtesting a lot of the match mechanics, a lot of the like actual sport itself, you know, that was a lot of just kind of playtesting with friends one-on-one, you know, me trying a strategy and then letting them try a strategy. So that was a lot of back and forth, especially within the last few months. That's been a lot of what we've been doing.
Yeah, nice.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see it in the flesh, as they say, kind of.
Sure.
Let's go through the structure of the game a bit. So it takes place over 2 weeks. Take us through, I guess, how it'll work for a player over those 2 weeks, kind of day to day.
Yeah, and so that was like a big question that was still like unknown up until about when we were deciding to like go live with tickets, was, you know, day-to-day interactions and how many interaction points will they have throughout the 2 weeks. And I got a lot of inspiration from like World Cup soccer, or like even a lot like the Olympics. Setting up like a, you know, how can we jam pack as much action within a short amount of time as possible. So the league itself is built a lot like the World Cup, where the teams are set up in groups and they have to play a bunch of different matches, and the teams with the best rank go on. So the 2 weeks play out like that, like play out like kind of a season of sports, or kind of like a, you know, the opening rounds of World Cup soccer. On a day to day, all of the actions are driven on those specific match days, and we have them play a match every other day, basically. So they'll play a match on Monday, there'll be a rest day, and then they'll play again on Wednesday. And each role will have a different set of things that they can do or submit actions for on those days. So the coaches, which we call the head sages, they obviously are submitting their team roster for who's going to play that day. But they're also figuring out training for those players. So they're going to be able to say, okay, I want this person to be doing like strength training. And I need this person to go see our cleric because he's injured. So they'll be submitting those actions on match days.
Cool.
The general managers, what we're calling the hands, are doing quests. And the quests are actually interesting. They kind of are this expansive way. Like if you think about like sports animes or like different things where it's like it's not always just about the sports. There's like a bigger world happening and things happening in it. And so these quests are meant to expand the world outside of the sport. And so the hands can pick a quest for the players to go on and send them off to like investigate something or do something good around the community. But of course there's risks to going on a quest, right? So they might go out and then get injured and then they're not ready for the match, you know, the important match that's coming up next week. So that's what they're doing. And on top of that, they're facilitating trades with other teams. So they're able to talk to other hands and say, hey, you know, I have this player. He's a witch and he's pretty good, but we have a lot of witches. Do you want to trade for a sorcerer? That sort of thing. And then the last player is the owner or the lord, lady, liege of the team. And they're doing things like meeting with the other owners and the like league office as a whole and trying to like pass bills and rules and regulations that will like cover the league, both the this year's league and potentially how the league might look in later iterations of the game.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Right. I got to say, when like I am signed up to play and I was looking forward to it, but I can't say I had this much depth of an understanding of what I was getting into.
Yeah.
And I'm really keen at this point. When I did my last mega game for the Crown, one thing that I trialed in selling it to new people was defining the rules. In the rules, each role, I kind of gave a bit of a glimpse at the mechanics to say, if you're a person who really likes cards and dice games, then you'll be really good in this role.
Yeah.
And if you're a person who really likes to debate or negotiate, then you'll do this. How would you sell each of those three roles to sort of different gaming styles?
Yeah, and that is something that is very tricky about mega games. It's like the gift and curse that you can have all of these different styles of play in one mega game. But that means that your experience will vary wildly from both your personality and which role you were able to pick, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So with the owners, you know, I really wanted to give them the sense of like they are kind of like the super rich, you know, millionaires and billionaires that own the team, but they have a lot of power as to how the league looks overall. Right. A lot of the, you know, when you look at like the NBA or the NFL and you see how much the owners like really can push certain aspects of the game, including like going down to like the granularity of the rules from time to time. Right. They have a lot of say as to how the game should be played. So that part I wanted to kind of reflect. Kind of being in like a government or trying to be like, you know, I have all this money, but I also need to work inside this like centralized ruling body. So how can I negotiate with those people? With the hand, a lot of the impetus or that was a lot more with the trading aspect. So being able to like talk to other teams and being like, okay, I need to make this deal. How can I give you like, I'll give you two players plus draft picks or, you know, plus X amount of money to give me your star player, that sort of thing. So it's more of a like inter-team, more personal negotiation. Mm-hmm. So for players that really like making deals, that's the kind of player that should look to be playing a hand. And then the head sages are kind of the most directly involved with the sport itself. So if you enjoy playing like fantasy football, like I was mentioning, or thinking about the sport in general, like the actual gameplay of the sport, then that's where I'd say you'd want to be a head sage and, you know, work with the players that you have to figure out the best way to win.
Yeah. Awesome. That sounds really, really cool.
One question I had briefly is going back a bit to the asynchronous nature of the game, where people, so it's one day on and then one rest day. During that one day that people are on, is it a thing where they can submit orders at any time, or do you have a specific time when people need to log on?
We wanted to avoid having those moments where people have to log on at a specific time, specifically to allow for, you know, folks like yourself who are going to be literally like 14 hours different than a lot of the other players. So I think pretty early we said it wouldn't be a thing about everyone has to be here at once. It would be more of a deadline aspect. So we'd be saying, okay, everyone needs to submit their things at 9 p.m. Eastern. And that way you're given the 2 days to negotiate that time. So, you know, on the rest day, even though you're not submitting submitting an action, that's when you're going to be taking that time to, like, you know, message with other teams, try and negotiate with them, so that you know for the day you are submitting an action what you might be doing, either in cooperation with them, going against them, however you want to play that out.
With our game Dark and Stormy, one thing that became apparent and one thing that came through in the feedback as well was that we were doing a similar thing where we didn't have rest days. I suppose the rest day was the evenings where the game would stop, and that's when we resolved a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But we were working to a deadline and people had to do certain actions before that deadline. Mm-hmm. One thing that we encountered was that a lot of the game was about, there was quite a bit of mystery and deception in the game. And so a lot of people wanted to leave it to the last minute to do their actions so that no one could oppose them. But also there was a lot of actions which people did in the dark and, you know, on the side, which were going to impact other players in the game. And so the order in which things happened was really important. Do you see any of that becoming a bit of an issue for you with our league?
Yeah, that was something we were pretty conscious of too. Was we wanted players to be able to have that leeway to like negotiate something and then either back out or do something else. We took a lot of time in figuring out what, you know, not only what the deadline looks like, but also what options are viable as actions, so that we're not putting ourselves in those weird spots. Like for instance, like I would have really loved to have a draft at the beginning of the game, and in our first playtest we actually did have a draft. But it required so much coordination with all the people that it was, I would say, almost half of the time I had with my playtesters was just scheduling the draft. And that was something where it's like, I can see everyone wanting it, but also it's just not viable in this format, right? So it took a little bit of discipline of being like, well, I really like this, but I don't think it'll work in that space.
Yeah, that's something I think might be a thing that that's something we need to think about a lot anyway. So with the playtest, just to give you an idea, our playtest was over 3 days of asynchronous play. And each day opened up at 9 a.m. And each day at 9 a.m. we would post a newspaper saying, here's what's going on today. And then we would close it off at 7 p.m., which is the last limit to make actions. And on the first day, we had people doing actions throughout the day, as we kind of expected. On the second day, we found that almost everyone posted their action at 6 p.m. or like 6:58 p.m. Like, people were pushing it as far as they possibly could. Like, we had a lot of people who were like there with their fingers on the buzzer, ready to do their action at exactly 6:59. And then that obviously cascaded to the tech side of things, is that we had a lot of things lagging because everyone was trying to submit an action at 6:59 p.m. You know, anyway.
Sure.
So that's something we need to think about a lot more.
And the reason, like one of the main reasons that happened was because the actions taken in the game, half of them were secret and half not. So people doing public actions could be sabotaged, or there could be actions taken behind the scenes to help deter them or defend against them or whatever. So that's what motivated people to do that. Is there, do you see any of that bleeding over, or do you think you've managed to avoid it?
Well, I was curious too. So like, is in your game, is there something where submission priority is determined by when you put it in? So like, if your action goes first, if you submitted first, basically.
Yeah, we didn't have a mechanic like that. I think really possibly, we're going to chat about this more in another podcast probably, but I think the reason why it happened fundamentally is that the structure of the game was set up as a fairly cooperative thing. You know, people posting public actions, and then other people would help you out with your public action, right? So the idea was that everyone would post public actions throughout the day. But in play, we found that people were acting a lot more competitively, and they didn't trust anyone, and there was a lot more mistrust than we probably expected to occur. Okay. And so that resulted in a situation where nobody wanted anyone else to see what their public action was going to be, or to help them with their public action. You know, they wanted which was just not what it was, not the intention at all. So yeah, right, that's probably the result.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of the Owl League, there's just not as many, I would say there's just not as many interaction points that are hidden, or at least when I say they're hidden, it's not, most things, you know, you more or less know who was doing those actions. So that is going to be part of it, is that teams are going to be aware, you know, when trades happen, they're going to know, okay, this person moves from one team to another, and that that affected how play is going to come out. I think there's going to be a lot of things globally that will happen that might have occurred because a team did something. I'm hoping it plays out in a kind of global story sense, that it, everyone can still interact with it, but not necessarily know that, you know, this happened because a team kind of worked with Control to do something interesting or do something crazy.
Yeah, definitely. That kind of brings me to my next question, which is, what do you think will be the biggest challenge in running Owl League? Like, what would you say you're most nervous about?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the tech and making sure everything kind of runs smoothly. That first mega game was like, I think a lot of the problems I was finding was really just logistics. So the more I hope that players are able to have a comfortable way of interacting with the game, the happier I'll be. But of course, like, you know, tech is so finicky from time to time, so it's going to be interesting to see how it looks with players, you know.
You've mentioned logistics and the tech a few times, and we're across a few online games which have used the same kind of, the Discord, the Google Sheets, and even Roll20. Are you taking a similar approach with Owl League? What's the key format?
So Discord, definitely for the interaction, like the communication between players. The data behind the scenes is run with Google Sheets, but what we have done is use this application called Glide that also takes Google Sheets and basically creates a web app or like a mobile app automatically from that data. And so it's basically making a UI for your Google Sheets.
Oh, cool.
And so we're using a lot of that to like do form entry, and sort of kind of the game input nature is a lot through this Glide app that I built. And then it funnels into the Google Sheet where, you know, I'm doing a little bit of spreadsheet magic and a little bit of manual moving and jostling, but otherwise, like, yeah, it's a lot of the similar tech.
Awesome. That sounds really cool. I think that was one thing that came through in our playtest and in our conversation with others about online mega games, that the software or the medium that you're running with really needs some customization. It really needs to be fit for purpose. And once you start just adapting things, it gets a bit tricky.
Yep. Yeah. And like one of the biggest, I'd say probably the biggest innovation of like tabletop in general has always been UI, right? Like there's always been these games for decades that people have enjoyed. And the reason they're enjoying it now in these reprints is because, you know, they've updated the way it looks. It becomes more readable and more people are understanding that language. And I think, you know, sometimes when you provide a spreadsheet to someone, it's like, okay, I think I get what I'm doing here, but it's difficult, you know. It's like you're kind of thrown back into like the classroom and thinking about like doing math and things like that. And that part I want to try and avoid as much as I can.
Yeah. And so when the game comes around and hopefully tech is not an issue, what are you most excited to see out of it?
Yeah, I think I'm just most excited to see those emergent storylines come out, you know, of like which teams are going to kind of figure out the game the fastest and start winning matches, the different like strategies that, you know, I might not have seen yet. I'm very excited to see people play those out. I'm curious also to see what people enjoy or like what they want to do with the world as a whole, right? So I was saying about those owners being able to dictate how gameplay is, right? Even to the point of saying like, you know, we should be having more points instead of less points, making things more dynamic. It almost plays out as if it's a, you know, a democratic process of like, what, how do you want this game to be? Do you want it to be, do you want it to have more points? Do you want to have the less points? Do you want it to, you know, be more beneficial to certain teams or less beneficial? So I am curious on that aspect, like how much people will be playing to their own interests versus playing to the interests of the league as a whole and things like that, you know?
Yeah. No, that sounds really cool. I'm personally really interested to see how having spectators goes, just using the forum. There's a lot of games that concepts I've come up with in the past, and one that I'm particularly working on right now, which I feel like would benefit from having this spectator base or some kind of like passive thing that can influence the game in minor ways, but it's not a full investment of time being a player. So I'm really interested just to see how that works in the format, let alone, you know, you're not having spectators really impact the game, but I'm just keen to follow that side story to see how they interpret it and enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think that aspect is so huge, both for the way the game can be played, but obviously for getting more people invested in playing games like this, right? Like the way people interact with like Twitch streams and kind of live online games like that are already doing a lot of that stuff. And I think this is where mega games can now start to like integrate with some of that stuff.
Definitely. I think that's always been one of the biggest barriers to getting people excited or interested in mega games, is that it's very hard to communicate what it actually is without going to one.
It's so high concept for a lot of people. Just
it like, is. It's like, oh, there's 50 people and you play it over a day and you do a bunch of stuff. Yeah. Like, it's a lot. And the debate on what is a mega game rages on, of course. Yep. But, like, being able to just say, hey, just join this Twitch stream and you can just watch it for 15 minutes and see what's actually going on, that is, I think, something that is going to be really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I don't know. Have you guys seen... Yelly's Marble Runs? It's a YouTube channel.
No.
So I've actually, within the last few weeks, I've gotten very interested in this, especially for the Owl League. But basically what they do is they recreate races, like actual sports races. Formula One races, but with marbles, right?
Mm. Right.
So... one of the major car companies actually like took their Formula E, their electronic, electric car race, and did a sponsorship with them to basically recreate their whole Formula E Grand Prix in this marble run. And it showed immediately that, like, when you put the production value of someone who, like, an actual sport onto this thing that is, like, effectively a bunch of marbles going down a track, like, it's completely silly and nonsense. But, like, just by putting that veneer on it or putting that, like, production value on it, all of a sudden, opens the door for a lot of people. And it's like, oh, wow, like, this is exciting. This is, like, as real as you can feel when you're rooting for your own sports team,
Yeah, I like it. I've just done a quick Google, and I think I have seen some of these or similar.
Yeah, and like people are so into those teams, like they root for them like they're their local sports team.
Yeah, awesome.
That's interesting.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all of the questions we really had for you today, Stefan. Thanks so much for joining us and running through it. We're super excited to play it and experience our league for ourselves. Did you have anyone you want? Oh, sorry. Here you go.
No, I was going to say thank you for having me, and I'm also excited for you guys to play it and for all of us to kind of be in a mega game together,
first time. It'll be amazing. Did you have anyone you wanted to give a shout out to, or and also where can people find you if they're looking for more info?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of my game stuff is going to be on my new game group called Magic Coffee House, and you can find out a lot about all the games that I'm doing there at magiccoffee.house is the URL. So you can see all the social media stuff there. I'm also doing a lot of stuff with the Mega Game Coalition here in North America. So, shouts to them and, Peter Nixon and Leslie Loy, who've been huge at like keeping that community alive in online as we, are unable to play in person. And with that, we're also trying to set up a online conference to, help facilitate folks moving their games from physical to a digital space, but also just like kind of putting together something that we're hoping will be kind of like a, if you build it, they will come sort of thing, where, it'll drive more people, more designers to build online games, and then more players that haven't had the opportunity to play games to now be able to play them. So that's what we're hoping to do pretty soon.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for having a chat to us. Looking forward to our league. And we'll see you then.
Yeah, when it's done, I'd love to come back and hear talk to you guys about it.
Yeah, for sure. Always
amazing, yeah.
Always welcome. Thanks very much for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me at the sydneymegagamers.com or hello@sydneymegagamers.com. And you can also find us on Facebook as Sydney Mega Gamers.
And if you want to get in contact with me, you can try jack@ashtowngames.com or via the Facebook page, Brisbane Mega Games. Join us next time when we'll be chatting to John Keyworth of Kiwi Game Design about his upcoming online mega game, The Anubis Heresy.